B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. Here in Northern California, the skies are smoky again. The Wine Country fires are being brought under control, but there is a new blaze in the Santa Cruz Mountains near the town of Boulder Creek, where I first lived when I transplanted to California 41 years ago. Early indications are they'll be able to bring that under control, and I hope that is the case. A lot of breaking news today, a lot of important issues that deserve attention that are often ignored by the corporate media in this country. You'll hear a lot about the announcement by a federal court in Hawaii that at the very last minute, the Trump travel ban, the Muslim ban 3.0 that was due to go into effect tomorrow, has largely been put on hold. Now, portions of it were allowed to go forward, but it's almost laughable, as we will detail. So a federal judge has largely blocked the implementation of the latest version of the travel ban, setting up another legal showdown. And because the trial court originates in Hawaii, appeals will be heard in the uber-liberal, well, it used to be uber-liberal, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. The decision came from Judge Derek Watson, and it means the administration cannot restrict the entry of travelers from six of the eight countries, and those are all Muslim. The six are all Muslim countries, Muslim majority. And it's because officials were either unable or unwilling to provide information that the United States wanted to vet their citizens. The latest ban was supposed to go into effect at midnight tonight, and it bars various types of travelers from Syria, Libya, Iran, Yemen, Chad, Somalia, and two non-Muslim nations, North Korea and Venezuela. So Watson's order will put it on hold temporarily. He allowed the ban on travel from North Korea and aimed at certain officials in Venezuela to remain in place. And I do consider that laughable, because those were little garnishes that were added to make it appear that this was not a Muslim ban. And the narrow focus of the ban on Venezuelans is aimed at reprisal at the socialist Maduro government. And almost nobody travels to the United States from North Korea. So that's like saying, you know, the travel ban includes people from Mars. So it's a 40-page decision. Watson says the latest ban suffers from precisely the same maladies as its predecessor. It lacks sufficient findings that the entry of more than 150 million nationals from six specified countries would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. He also says the executive order plainly discriminates based on nationality in a way that is opposed to federal law and the founding principles of the nation. So the Supreme Court is going to be facing an appeal on this, and they have dodged earlier versions by letting them expire and declaring them moot. But the state of Hawaii made the argument that Trump has exceeded his legal authority to set immigration policy, and that this is an unconstitutional fulfillment of his campaign promise to implement a Muslim ban. According to the challengers in Hawaii, quote, it exceeds the limits on the president's exclusion authority that have been recognized for nearly a century by supplanting congressional immigration policies with the president's own unilateral and indefinite ban. And it continues to effectuate the president's unrepudiated promise to exclude Muslims from the United States. So I do have to caution you that it appears to me, and I'm not a legal expert, that the refinements made to the third version of the royal decree from Trump banning Muslims may actually be upheld if it ever reaches the Supreme Court. And it's because of the broad latitude given to the president to exclude people from legal immigration to the United States. So we'll continue to watch that. Now, I have three important stories updating the fate of individuals held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And in large part, these are people who are just forgotten. Some are being left to languish there without trial or charge indefinitely. Others are being denied basic rights. And in a Supreme Court decision, It's actually a declining to hear a case brought by a prisoner from Guantanamo. They have turned down the opportunity to hear an appeal from a prisoner accused of masterminding the USS Cole bombing, which occurred in 2000. And the date is critical because whether or not this individual, al-Nashiri of Saudi Arabia, is guilty, he is petitioning to be tried in a federal court instead of before the military tribunals, the kangaroo courts that are so slow and riddled with injustice that are held at Guantanamo. The 52-year-old al-Nashiri says, look, the law is clear. Terrorism cases brought before the military tribunals at Gitmo are limited to those who are charged with crimes that happened during hostilities. Now, the bombing of the USS Cole was before the very broad language of the authorization for use of military force that was the blank check that was given to Bush after 9/11. And this is a critical issue that the Supreme Court now is openly dodging. And this is a gross injustice because al-Nashiri is unlikely to get a hearing at Guantanamo anytime soon, considering that his entire civilian defense team resigned on Friday, not because of this pending Supreme Court decision not to take the case, but because they are suspicious that the government has surveilled, listened in on their confidential conversations with their client. And this is an issue that has arisen before. In 2013, a military lawyer acknowledged that the meeting rooms at Guantanamo contained microphones disguised as smoke alarms. And they say, oh, we don't use them. We don't listen in, but we could. And so the lawyers, including J. Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights, say that Nashiri could easily wait another 10 years before the resolution of his case. He was tortured at a CIA black site, and that's one of the reasons why his process of being tried has moved so slowly. Our government does not want to air out the evidence and the implications of the torture program that was conducted. Then we have the case of a man who has collaborated with the U.S. government since 2002. He is another Saudi national, Ahmed Haza al-Darbi. And al-Darbi, who was picked up in 2002, he apparently was an associate of Osama bin Laden, and he has admitted, he pled guilty to charges of his role in a 2002 attack by al-Qaeda on a French oil tanker off the coast of Yemen. So he pled guilty, hoping to just get this process going and at some point get the hell out of there. So on Friday, he was sentenced to 13 years in prison. Now, he's already been there 12 years, and they denied him any credit for time served, despite the fact that he has been an open supporter or, you know, he has provided evidence. He has given testimony against Nashiri, who I just talked about, in the Cole case. And despite his cooperation, they decided to give him zero credit for time served, and it apparently is going to be up to Trump whether an agreement that was made with Darby and his lawyers during the Obama administration will be honored to permit him to serve out the rest of his sentence in Saudi Arabia starting as soon as the spring of next year. And so even people who cooperate get screwed and are dealt further injustices even after 12 years and cooperation with the authorities at Guantanamo. And my friend Andy Worthington, the British journalist who has provided the best ongoing coverage of the barbaric prison in Cuba, he has a post including a statement from the Pakistani hunger-striking prisoner, Ahmed Rabbani. And we pointed out last week that quietly the Trump administration changed the policies at Guantanamo for hunger strikers. They're essentially challenging them to kill themselves. They're going to let them die. And while I have criticized the barbarism of forced feeding, Andy Worthington airs out those moral issues and then says, look, there is a third option beyond force feeding or starving themselves to death, and that is for them to get a fair trial, charged, and either charge them or release them. Of the 41 men still held at Guantanamo, only 10 are facing or have faced charges, 5 are approved for release but are still being held, and 26 others are officially held without charge or trial. Now, Obama did try to reduce the population as much as possible. I'm not sure about those 5 who have been approved for release and still have not been let go. But I want to read some highlights from the statement by Rabbani that has been published in Newsweek this week. He says, I'm a taxi driver from Karachi. 15 years ago, I was sold for a bounty and taken by the U.S. military to a secret prison in Afghanistan. They mistook me for someone called Hassan Ghul. And if you pay attention to these issues, Ghul is the one whose family brought charges against the torture architects, Mitchell and Jessen, in the trial that was settled out of court in Spokane about a month ago. And Ghul died while in custody, being essentially left to freeze to death while he was being given the naked treatment. So, this was mistaken identity. There's no disputing this, says Rabbani. It's in the U.S. Senate report on torture. I've been held here ever since without charge or trial. In May 2013, without any way of defending myself or securing my freedom, I resorted to peaceful protest and began a hunger strike. I have tried to keep my dignity, insisting on going to force feedings by myself rather than being dragged to the chair by the forcible cell extraction team. Now, on September 20th, things abruptly changed. A new punitive regime has begun, one which deprives us of the proper medical surveillance we so badly need. Now, the rules are that if your weight went down more than 20% of your pre-hunger strike weight, that's when they would start force-feeding you. Well, this guy was 135 pounds when he started his hunger strike. He's down well under 100 pounds. But he says, they don't bring anyone to check my vitals, weigh me, or force feed me. The doctors here do what the new medical boss tells them. He wants me to beg him for food, but I will not. He is like a dictator. They tell me it's my fault if I die, but all I'm asking for is basic justice, a fair trial, or freedom. I know I am innocent, but I am not allowed to prove it. I don't want to die, but they will not succeed in breaking my strike. I will not stop demanding justice. Then he gets personal with Trump. I have a message for President Trump. He's a businessman. The government doesn't have a case against any of us. Instead of wasting $11 million a year on each prisoner they hold on this island by killing us, why not bring us to court where we can defend ourselves? Then he can turn this place into a museum and charge money for people who visit. This is a rather smart and, slightly snarky approach, but there's little to argue with in his appeal to the profiteering instincts of one Donald Trump. He closes by saying, maybe I will die as a result of this hunger strike. Maybe I will lose my sight and go blind. Even so, in here I have nothing to see. One thing is clear, that one day the authorities at Guantanamo will be held responsible for what they have done. Now, there's a lot of chatter in the media today, and Rachel Maddow devoted a lengthy segment on her program last night to the ugly and false comments that Trump made yesterday. He held an impromptu news conference with Mitch McConnell standing by, trying to say what great unity the Republicans have. And he was asked why he has yet to contact the families of 4 American soldiers who were killed in Niger in an ambush 2 weeks ago. And instead of answering the question, he shifted the focus to what President Obama and other presidents did or didn't do, whether or not they made phone calls or other ways of contacting the families of troops who died in combat. And the New York Times, to its credit, in the headline says Trump falsely claims Obama didn't contact families of fallen troops. The opening sentence, President Trump falsely asserted on Monday that Obama and other presidents didn't contact the families of troops killed in duty. Trump's assertion, the article continues, belied a long record of meetings Obama held with the families of killed service people, as well as calls and letters dating to the earliest days of his presidency. And Ben Rhodes, who is a guy who was a national security advisor to Obama, tweeted, "This is an outrageous, disrespectful lie, even by Trump standards." Also, Obama never attacked a Gold Star family. And what I find interesting is, yes, this is offensive. Yes, it is dishonest. But what about the cause of these conflicts? What about the U.S. involvement in hot combat activities in multiple nations? It rarely gets reported. So let's do a quick rundown of where America is fighting and where we are using proxy fighters to do dirty deeds. Today, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a euphemism for Kurdish Syrians who have been used by the United States as the frontline fighters against the Islamic State, they are claiming that they have liberated Raqqa. More than 90% of Raqqa is in Syrian Democratic Force control. The U.S. says that it's in the process, it's on the verge of being liberated, but the military commander for the Syrian Democratic Forces, and there's nothing really democratic about Syria, is the military operation is over. Now, this is one example of the way the United States has ruthlessly used Kurdish fighters to advance whatever our mission happens to be. And those missions are vague, undefined, and part of, if you'll excuse the expression, the ongoing bloody clusterfuck in Syria. Now, across the border in Iraq, the surprise is that the American-backed Kurdish forces there did not stand and fight against the invading Iraqi army that took control of Kirkuk and the surrounding oil fields. And I'm surprised by this because it was the flip of 2014, when the Islamic State marched into Mosul and the Iraqi forces melted away after billions of dollars and years of military training by the United States. So I don't understand what kind of backroom deal was worked, but the Kurdish Peshmerga got orders to leave the area from their superiors in Erbil, the capital of the region that is conduct an independence referendum and has aspirations to become the center of a new Kurdish state. And so this is something that needs to be explained, but we don't get much coverage about America's ongoing wars or the expansion of U.S. military action in Yemen. We have been quietly supporting the Saudi forces that have been brutally assaulting the nation, trying to rout the Houthis who are nominally in control or are struggling to regain control of the war-torn nation of Yemen. The Pentagon announced U.S. airstrikes had struck two Islamic State training camps in a certain part in the center of the country, where they said that recruits were being trained. This is part of a sharply increased bombing campaign against both the Islamic State, which has only been in Yemen since 2015 and is probably just an opportunistic franchise situation, and Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, which has been there since about, 2011. Neither of these entities existed when the legal authority, I referenced it earlier, Bush's authorization for use of military force, was put into effect. And so we are operating without any U.S. legal authority for the military adventures that continue since Trump took office. Now, I want to be clear that I criticized Obama for using Yemen as a shooting gallery. But it appears that Trump is bigly trying to expand on what Obama had been doing. So this is just more U.S. military action around the world that is off the radar of most Americans who get distracted by Trump's tweets and, you know, all of the bullshit that is passing for important news every day coming out of Washington. In addition, you may have heard that over the weekend, it was last Saturday, in the city of Mogadishu in Somalia, there were two truck bombs that led to the deaths of at least 300 people, likely many more. And you say, well, you know, they're just fighting it out, these crazy Somalians. But it is likely that the attack on Saturday may have been motivated by a desire for revenge for a botched U.S.-led operation in August that led to the deaths of 10 civilians. Now, we rarely see the causes of the events, the military actions taken by the United States. We're the good guys. We got the white hats. Not white helmets, just white hats. And we, you know, operate as responding to the, you know, brazen provocations and terrorist elements. And a lot of this is explainable as reaction to American operations. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like, oh, let's go to the list here, Susan Lundgren, George Reeves, Andrew Harnack, and David Michaelets. They're all regular subscribers to this podcast, and I really appreciate their support. I'd like to be announcing your name here sometime. And if you've never heard it, you can fix that. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com, pull down the menu on any platform or device, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where you've got choices of $5, $10, $20 a month or our $50 annual subscription. And I hope you can find it in your budget to support my independent media operation here at the PBC Podcast. Yesterday, we reported on the important investigation co-operated by the 60 Minutes team and Washington Post investigators, showing that the opioid epidemic was allowed to continue as the death toll mounted and as many people who were cut off from opioids of the prescription type shifted to street drugs like heroin and the very dangerous fentanyl. And we explained that one of the architects of a law to prevent the DEA from stopping the flow to distributors of questionable shipments of oxycodone and related opioids, Tom Marino, a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, he had been appointed to the so-called drug czar position by Donald Trump as a reward for his early loyalty to the Trump campaign last year. But today, Trump tweeted that Tom Marino is withdrawing his name, but he's still a fine man and a great congressman, so he can resume his efforts to protect those who are most responsible for the wave of drug deaths in this country. And it's a huge crisis. People pay lip service to it. Trump is going to launch a promotional campaign next week. But nobody's going after Purdue Pharmaceutical, the company that has profited massively from the development and distribution of these highly addictive drugs. And it's likely that the distributors named by 60 Minutes, including the McKesson Company here in San Francisco, will continue to profit. And it only cost them $100 million in donations to the political campaigns of congressional members of both parties. You may have heard that on the island nation of Malta, there was a car bomb that blew up and killed investigative journalist and blogger Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was killed on Monday, and it's because she had exposed corruption among the leadership in Malta using the evidence provided by the release of the so-called Panama Papers at the beginning of this year. And her son, also a journalist, posted on Facebook, "My mother was assassinated because she stood between the rule of law and those who sought to violate it, like many strong journalists. But she was also targeted because she was the only person doing so. This is what happens when the institutions of the state are incapacitated. The last person left standing is often a journalist, which makes her the first person left dead. Her Peugeot was destroyed by an explosive device so powerful that it blew the car into a nearby field." And just a half hour before she was assassinated, Miss Galizia, age 53, posted online, "There are crooks everywhere. Everywhere you look now, the situation is desperate." And this is the height of hypocrisy, because one of her targets is Malta's Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, and two of his closest aides. Muscat denounced her killing, calling it a barbaric act on press freedom. "I will not rest until I see justice done in this case." It's kind of like O.J., looking for the real killer. And her son, Matthew Galizia, criticized, quote, "that clown of a prime minister, making statements to parliament about a journalist he spent over a decade demonizing and harassing." And he also highlighted a Facebook post by a police sergeant who, minutes after the murder, posted, "Everyone gets what they deserve, cow dung," feeling happy. And the son concluded, "Yes, this is where we are, a mafia state, where you will be blown to pieces for exercising your basic freedoms, only for the people who are supposed to have protected you to instead be celebrating it." Meanwhile, in Catalonia, the central court, national court in Madrid, has denied bail to two leaders of the independence movement. They're both the first named Jordi Sanchez and Jordi Cuixart. Both are leaders of elements of the independence movement there. They're accused of using huge demonstrations to stop Spanish police from trying to halt the independence referendum on October 1st. And the president in Catalonia, Carles Puigdemont, he quickly denounced the move and described both men as political prisoners. But the rigid and ruthless central government spokesman said, "We can talk of politicians in prison, but not political prisoners. These are not political prisoners because yesterday's prison ruling was due to a crime." And I predict that this is going to be a messy situation as the Barcelona activists continue to petition Madrid for dialogue. We know about the refugee crisis in Myanmar, formerly called Burma. The minority Muslim population called the Rohingya are being brutally evicted from the country, and they're holing up in refugee camps in a neighboring country. Now we hear that a UN food agency, apparently for political reasons and perhaps for the effort to continue trying to provide food relief to starving members of the Rohingya community, earlier this summer, the World Food Program of the UN warned that more than 80,000 children under the age of 5 were wasting, meaning a potentially fatal condition of rapid weight loss. And they pulled the report after protests from the government of Myanmar and said that they were collaborating on a revised version. Well, yesterday, the executive director of the food program told the Guardian newspaper that it should not have been removed. He's directed it to be republished in its original form. But this shows that the Nobel Peace Prize winning de facto leader of Myanmar is conducting a brutal ethnic cleansing. Her name is hard to pronounce, Aung San Suu Kyi. But she defends this on the narrow point that Rohingya insurgents attack security forces. Well, those security forces were burning villages, raping women, and forcing Rohingyas out of their home communities. And, of course, this is viewed as terrorism on the part of the victims. So it does appear that the initial motive of suppressing this report was to maintain the ability to deliver humanitarian relief. And so I'm not demonizing the World Food Program, but it is a very distressing development. As you may know, I am a fan of the young journalist Kevin Gastola, who publishes at Shadowproof. I'm linking to one of his reports today about a federal court in Chicago that basically says that your fingerprint used to open your iPhone is not under your control. Now, this is a bizarre ruling about the Fifth Amendment and our right to prevent self-incrimination. And get this, if you have an iPhone and you have a digital password, a government official cannot compel you to enter the password because that requires thought. But according to this court ruling, they can compel you to press your finger against the ID sensor. Why? Well, because of a Supreme Court precedent that authorities can force displays of physical features. For example, a person may be forced to put on a shirt to see if it fits, or I guess a glove. I am hung up on OJ today. You can be forced to provide a blood sample. You can submit to be required to submit to fingerprinting or photographs or provide a voice or handwriting sample. But the use of a password is something that requires your thought, and so you can refuse to do that. But the court said the government agents will pick the fingers to be pressed on the Touch ID, so there is no need to engage the thought process of the individual in effectuating the seizure. This is bullshit. This is a clear constitutional violation, and I hope that it will be appealed and overturned. And finally today, the case of Colin Kaepernick. First, you must understand that I gave up on the NFL a long time ago before it became fashionable, either for people who are patriotic to the core and demand that everyone stand for the national anthem, or before the wave of taking a knee in protest of injustice in the United States became widespread. That said, I have long supported the expression of Colin Kaepernick. And yesterday he filed a grievance against the NFL, actually it was Sunday, accusing team owners of colluding to deny him employment this season because of his activism. In a statement issued by Mark Garagos, the celebrity attorney who is representing Kaepernick, he said if the NFL is to remain a meritocracy, then principled and peaceful political protests, which the owners themselves made great theater imitating weeks ago, should not be punished, and athletes should not be denied employment based on partisan political provocation by the executive branch of our government, referring to Trump's son-of-a-bitch tweet. Now, I think this is an interesting case, and I fully support Mr. Kaepernick. But the esteemed Bob Agelko, the legal affairs journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, notes that in the legal forum that will judge Kaepernick's complaint, it can be extremely difficult to prove. He is going to be forced into arbitration. It's not completely binding. The findings of the arbitrator can be appealed. But take the case of Barry Bonds, the San Francisco Giants drug-addled super hitter. You know, he was accused and he was tried and acquitted of using performance-enhancing drugs, one called the Clear, that he thought would evade detection by the drug tests administered by a Major League Baseball. So in his case, it took 6 years for the arbitration process to be completed, and Barry Bonds lost because he couldn't prove that the owners had colluded to prevent him from working after he was accused of using the drugs. And so Kaepernick will have to show some kind of communication, collusion, between at least two of the 32 NFL team owners or managers in order to prove a case. And he may be over the hill, too old to play, by the time the issues are resolved. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast all the way to the end. It's available free every day and on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until